This is Audible.
Zondervan presents Thunder of Heaven, a Joshua Jordan novel, book two in the End series, by Tim LaHaye and Craig Parshall. Read by Stefan Rudnicki. Part 1. An ill wind blowing. We can absorb a terrorist attack. President Barack Obama, quoted in Obama's Wars by Bob Woodward. Under the last administration, as well as under this one, it has been the United States policy not to build a missile defense that would render useless Russia's nuclear capabilities. Testimony of the Secretary of Defense before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, July 2010. Al-Qaeda's continued efforts to access chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear material pose a serious threat to the United States. Testimony of FBI Director Robert Mueller before Congress, March 2010. Chapter 1. In the Near Future. In a small warehouse in Howard Beach, a few miles outside the fence of JFK International Airport, Hassan was going over the details with his two partners. He stared into the eyes of Farhat, the young Turkish man who was fidgeting with a set of car keys. Hassan had his doubts about him, but kept them to himself. The mission was too important to risk just because Farhat hadn't given himself completely to the cause. Farhat's level of commitment had to be probed. Hassan was afraid that his young recruit was more concerned about his pretty girlfriend back in Istanbul than he was about the mission. "Farhat," Hassan began, "the time has come. Are you with us?"
"Yes. Why do you doubt me?"
"I don't waste time doubting. I believe. I decide. Then I act." Farhat nodded and looked over at the third man, Ramzi, a Palestinian on loan from Hamas. With his arms crossed, Ramzi looked uninterested until he spoke up.
"Fine. Then we start."
Ramzi motioned to several large fuel tanks in the corner of the warehouse.
"But what about those?"
Hassan smiled and said, "Don't smoke." He held a sat phone, the newest generation of digitally encrypted satellite cell phones. He clicked it on and waited until a woman inside the terminal answered.
"Talk to me," said Hassan.
"National Airlines Flight 433 to Denver is boarded, waiting on the tarmac. Clearance has not yet been given. I will tell you when it starts taxiing down the runway."
"I will be waiting," said Hassan. "Remember, we need 2 minutes lead time."
The woman said, "I will make you proud."
After clicking off the sat phone, Hassan barked to Farhat,
"Recite your role in the plan again."
Farhat swallowed hard and spoke.
"I wait inside the van. I do not start the engine until I see your text on my all phone. I have 10 seconds to read it before it self-deletes. Then I turn on the ignition. Wait for you and Ramzi. If I see police or security, I turn off the van, get out, and walk over to tell you. But I don't run. If the mission is completed, then we all get in, and I drive exactly 3 miles per hour over the speed limit, no more, no less, to our destination. Don't run red lights. Obey all stop signs."
"The route?"
"Shore Parkway to I-278.
Hassan put his face close to Farhat's.
"One correction," said Hassan. "Not if the mission is completed. Get that straight. We will complete the mission. We must not fail."
Then, to put a point on it, Hassan poked a finger into Farhat's chest and said,
"Shaja'a."
Farhat wrinkled his brow. Hassan smiled. His one-word mandate to Farhat to have courage was meant as a warning.
"Allah Akbar!"
Hassan yelled out. Now they would wait, but not for long.
Deborah Jordan settled into seat 14A, next to the overwing emergency exit on the 797 parked on the tarmac of JFK. First class was filled, so she had settled for coach on her flight to Denver. At least she had extra footroom in that spot and no overhead storage compartment above her seat. Too bad, though, that her father's private Citation 10 jet was getting security upgrades and was unavailable. Otherwise, she'd have asked for a ride. Not that commercial flights bothered her. She didn't have a rich kid attitude. She just wanted to get home to her family's sprawling log mansion in Colorado. It was their family retreat. Sure, she loved their New York City penthouse, which was close to her father's Manhattan office, but the place in the Rockies held a special attraction for her. She studied the slow pack animal parade of passengers as they shuffled down the aisle and stuffed bags into the overhead compartments. As she put her purse on the floor by her feet, she stuffed her hand into the embossed leather bag and pulled out a small magazine, National Security Review. After buckling her seatbelt, she sat back and tried to focus on her reading. Just then, a man in his early 30s shoved his carry-on into an overhead, took the seat next to her, and flashed her a smile. He wore a golf shirt. Too tight, she thought. Maybe to show off his biceps, which she had to admit were impressive. A chiseled face and something interesting about the nose. It was off kilter, like it had been broken. Short hair, blue eyes. Uh-oh. He caught me looking. The man smiled again. Then Deborah, after tossing a tight-lipped nod in his direction, turned her attention back to the magazine. When the jet was full, an attendant bent over in her direction. There was a courteous smile and the standard question, was Deborah willing and able to activate the emergency exit door next to her if the need arose?
Absolutely. No problem.
The attendant disappeared, and the man next to her leaned toward her. You sure about that? I'd be glad to help out. The grin on his face told her two things. First, he was taking a clumsy stab at flirting. Second, it was a lame attempt at an icebreaker.
Thanks, but I can handle it.
Still managing a smile, he added, I'm sure you can. Just trying to be friendly. On the other side of the country, LAX airport seemed normal enough. Flights mostly on schedule. A few backups. Although no one seemed to know why, the security status had been raised for the TSA workers screening passengers at the X-ray machines. But then that had happened before. The security staffers in the dark blue shirts simply increased their number of random carry-on inspections. Outside on the tarmac, a couple of uniformed airport cops slouched against an LAX ops police squad car. They talked casually, squinting behind their Ray-Ban sunglasses in the glare of the California sun. One block outside the LAX perimeter, two men stood on the roof of an apartment building. One was a Muslim ex-military veteran from Chechnya. Next to him was an American-born Arab recruit from the U.S. Army. The location was ideal. It was on the line between Highway 405 and the tall rectangular airport control tower with the spiked exterior that looked like some kind of giant Lego construction. When everything went down, it would be a short drive to the 405, where they could then drop the hammer and merge into the crazy fast traffic from Los Angeles and escape the disaster scene. They would leave behind their signature, an exploding inferno and a mass of fatalities. Chapter 2. The good-looking guy next to Deborah kept glancing at her magazine. Then he moved from looking at the magazine to taking in her pretty face, softly square with double dimples and dark eyes. She braced herself. Great. Okay, here it comes. And it did. He nodded toward the publication and said, So, national security stuff. You work for a defense contractor? Deborah had to make a quick decision. Engage or activate avoidance measures. She decided that limited engagement was the safest course. Then she could get back to the article she was reading about nuclear deterrence in an age of asymmetrical warfare.
No, not with a defense contractor.
Military detail, then? Deborah weighed her answer.
Not exactly.
Without looking up, she added, Technically not. Intriguing. Okay.
Then you're in one of the academies. He eyed her closer. Air Force? Nah, I'm Air Force. You don't fit the profile.
Deborah tried to keep up the stone face. Profile? What profile is this guy talking about?
Not Navy. Not reading that kind of stuff. So that leaves West Point, right?
Deborah didn't realize she was blushing. Her seat partner kept talking.
Wow, direct hit.
Oh, sorry. Didn't introduce myself. Ethan March, formerly Lieutenant Major, United States Air Force, and now civilian. Glad to meet you, Miss, he reached out to shake her hand. Deborah threw him a side look and offered up a quick handshake and a short explanation.
You're right. I'm West Point.
Graduated?
One more year.
Congratulations, in advance.
Thanks. And you, Mr. March?
I go by Ethan. Defense contracting. Until recently. That got her attention.
Which company?
Raytheon. Just got laid off. Part of defense downsizing from Washington. Go figure. Deborah gave a nod, but she still looked underwhelmed by the chatty guy next to her. Ethan March made a rapid recovery. I've been lucky, though. Been around the block with some of the best. She couldn't resist.
Oh? Like who?
Well, for one, I had the privilege of serving under the great Colonel Joshua Jordan. Deborah dropped her magazine and broke into a grin, which slowly lapsed into laughter. Ethan flashed a look of disbelief. Then he said with some disgust, Army, can't believe it. You folks don't know how to honor a true blue Air Force hero like Colonel Jordan. When she stopped laughing, she explained,
You don't understand. You said you served with the great Joshua Jordan.
Exactly, at McGill Air Force Base.
Well, Joshua Jordan is my father, which I guess makes me, well, his almost great daughter.
Now Ethan was the one blushing. Oh, man, plane going down. Mayday, mayday. Now they were both laughing. She reached her hand over.
Let's start this again. I'm Deborah Jordan. Good to meet you.
They shook hands again, but this time he held on a little longer. I'm honored to be sitting with you. Figure that. Joshua Jordan's daughter.
Chapter 3.
Inside the cockpit of Northern Airlines Flight 199 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport, the co-pilot was reading off the pre-flight checklist. When he got to one item, he paused. Then the co-pilot read it out. Primary countermeasures. Pilot Bob Blotzinger, a veteran of 20 years of commercial flying, flicked the little toggle switch, and the green light on the instrument panel lit up. He said, Check. Secondary system. Check. The co-pilot stopped again for a second. Then after turning around to make sure the cockpit door was closed and they were alone, he asked,
What's the deal with that?
With what?
The secondary. You know, the RTS.
Hey, I'm just the pilot. Ask Northern Airlines. I only work here.
Come on, Bob. Humor me. Did the FAA really approve the return to sender defense system or not?
The pilot gave it some thought and tossed his first officer a tired look. Okay. This is only what I heard, so don't quote me. Apparently, the FAA clears the RTS for installation in commercial jets, right? But then Homeland Security gets involved and says, Whoa, wait a minute, this is national security stuff. So it starts getting complicated, like it always does. Now you've got a battle between two agencies. So they decide, okay, leave it installed. But each airline and each airport can jointly decide whether the system gets activated. Anyway, the FAA wants to see if having it physically installed jinxes anything in your avionics, which it shouldn't, from everything I know, but that's their compromise.
But you're not answering me. Are we able to use the RTS or not?
No, not really. Not automatically. Have to call it into air traffic control, give them the alert, get their permission first. Ridiculous.
The pilot waved his hand toward the pre-flight log in the co-pilot's hand.
All right. So sign off on the pre-flight, will you? I want to get to Dallas.
The co-pilot tilted his head as he listened in his headset to a message from the tower. He followed that with a nod.
Good news. They've moved us up. We're on deck.
By the time Flight 199 started taxiing down the runway at O'Hare, across the country, at JFK, Deborah's flight 433 to Denver was next in line for takeoff. At LAX, the Los Angeles to Las Vegas flight was in the same position. As the Chicago flight rolled toward takeoff, two men hunched together inside the Ulema salvage yard in Schiller Park, just outside of the O'Hare perimeter. An Indonesian man shouldered a FIM-92A Stinger missile launcher. His brother stood next to him, reading the quick text messages from the other cell groups in Los Angeles and New York. Just outside the Ulema salvage yard, the driver of the getaway van, with its engine idling, sat behind the steering wheel. He was watching the two-man Stinger team get ready. The brother's sat phone rang. He took the message and seemed electrified.
"Takeoff is confirmed for Flight 199 to Dallas," he yelled. "It's coming!"
A few seconds later, they could hear the big jet approaching in the distance. While Flight 199 was taking off from Chicago, Flight 433 out of JFK was slowly rolling down the runway. The 797 straightened its alignment for takeoff. The pilot eased the throttle forward. The jet started to accelerate. Then the pilot powered it up for takeoff. As the 797 raced down the runway, Deborah felt the familiar centrifugal force pulling her back into her seat. At that moment, her purse tipped over on the floor, spilling the contents. Lipstick, compact, coin purse, all phone cell, pens, everything. For a split second, she tried to fight the impulse, but she did it anyway. She quickly unbuckled her seatbelt so she could reach down and stuff the contents back into her purse. For Blotzinger, this was only his third time flying the new 797. He had 88 souls on board, including the crew and flight attendants, as he taxied the big jet into position for takeoff from O'Hare Airport. Moments later, Blotzinger gently lifted the big jet off the runway. Their flight path took them over Schiller Park, but when the jet was directly over Ulema Salvage Yard, the co-pilot noticed something. A blip on the radar screen. A blip streaking right toward them. Suddenly, the attack warning buzzers went off in the cabin, and a yellow light started to flash. The co-pilot blurted out, "Bob, incoming!" Blotzinger hit the countermeasures button. The flares designed to deflect heat-seeking missiles blew out from the underbelly, but they were not close enough to the Stinger missile to distract it. The missile kept streaking toward its target. Blotzinger could see what was happening.
"Fire the RTS!" he screamed.
The co-pilot hit the control for the RTS anti-missile system while Blotzinger swung the big jet into an avoidance pattern. Their eyes were riveted to the screen. But for some terrifying reason, the linear blip kept coming, closing in at a blinding speed, heading right for the belly of the jet. The RTS should have worked, should have instantaneously transmitted a data-capturing, data-reconfiguring laser beam aimed straight for the guidance system in the missile. Should have reversed the flight path of the FIM-92A Stinger that was streaking toward the jet and turned it around, sending it back to its source. But something had gone terribly wrong. The last sound on the cockpit voice recorder was a millisecond-long scream of the co-pilot when he got a glimpse of the long steel cylinder full of explosives momentarily flashing into sight just before it struck. There was an unearthly blast. And in one blinding explosion, they were all gone. On the ground, a man was walking his dog. He screamed and jumped at the sound of the sky exploding into fire overhead. His dog howled and cowered on the ground. When the man looked up, he saw the fireball expanding in the air. Then he screamed again. He saw the charred pieces of the fuselage, cockpit, and wing assembly falling from the sky all around him, and crashing onto the streets and houses of his Chicago suburb. Soon, National Airlines Flight 433 out of JFK would be winging its way high in the sky over the warehouse where Ramsey nestled the missile launcher against his shoulder. Standing directly below the now-open retractable skylight, Ramsey peered through the clear pane of plastic on the launcher's viewfinder, ready to line up the big 797 jet in its rectangular lines. As Deborah bent down to stuff the spilled items back into her purse, Ethan March joked, No seatbelt? Leave it to the Army to ignore flight regulations.
At that moment, the cockpit crew heard a shrill warning bell. The co-pilot pointed to a flashing light on the flight deck. An oblong object on the LCD screen was streaking toward them. The co-pilot shouted, "Oh my God!"
The pilot thrust his finger down on the primary countermeasure button. A flare shot out from the underbody of the jet toward the incoming heat-seeking missile in an attempt to detract it. But the missile kept coming. More alarm bells rang. The security screen flashed, 6 seconds to impact. The pilot punched the button marked RTS. A laser beam shot out of a small orb on the belly of the National Airlines jet. The beam struck the missile's guidance system right behind the heat-seeking tip. The pilot knew he had to put distance between the heat of his jet engines and the approaching missile, so he tried to bank into a 20-degree yaw to the left. Passengers screamed as magazines, jackets, and purses flew into the air. In an instant, Deborah, still out of her seatbelt, felt herself being lifted violently into the air. She would have smashed straight into the ceiling, head first, with the force of an automobile crash, if Ethan March hadn't instantly reached over her and blocked her with his arms and held onto her. Up front, a stewardess lay unconscious on the floor, having hit her head against the bulkhead before she had buckled into her jump seat. 500 feet away, the RTS laser beam had triggered the guidance system of the missile into a mirror image of its trajectory. The infrared head of the missile was deactivated, and the Stinger began a returning loop away from the jet. The missile was now on a path back to Earth at 1,500 miles per hour, returning to the warehouse where it had been launched. On the ground, Ramsey couldn't afford to wait even a few seconds to verify his hit. The Stinger missile left a visible plume behind it, and they had to clear out of the launch area before they were sighted. He hurriedly repacked the launcher into the case. Hassan was already sprinting toward Farhat and the van. That is when Hassan, standing outside, thought he saw the glint of something in the air, a thin metallic object streaking through the sky toward them. It was the last thing he would see. When the missile struck the warehouse, it ignited the fuel tanks. There was a flash and a deafening roar as the warehouse disintegrated in the enveloping ball of fire. Hassan, Ramzi, and Farhat were consumed instantly. 4 workers on the loading dock of the neighboring building were taking a break. They never knew what hit them. The shock wave from the blast blew them 100 feet from the building, which imploded behind them. Its windows sprayed broken glass in a shimmering mist as the walls buckled. The sonic blast could be heard all the way to the New Jersey shore. In the cockpit of Flight 433, the LCD screen on the flight deck was flashing field clear, and the buzzer ceased. The pilot corrected his flight path. Deborah found herself in a heap on Ethan's lap with his arms still locked around her. She climbed back into her seat as their hearts banged in their chests. Deborah threw a glance up to the ceiling of the plane, realizing what might have happened. She managed a smile and turned to Ethan.
"Thanks. Really."
In the cockpit, the pilot radioed the tower. "Permission requested to use RTS secondary countermeasures per FAA rules. Over."
"Hey, what happened? What's the permission requested for RTS?"
"Don't understand. Look, I'll just take that as permission granted. Thanks, tower. Over." 2 minutes later, the men on the roof near LAX airport were monitoring the Los Angeles flight to Las Vegas. They had already received an ecstatic voice message on their sat phone from the Chicago cell group. Plane down, Allah be praised. Now the Chechen was helping the Arab missile expert shoulder the Stinger launcher.
"Hear it? Listen. That's our jet," he cried out.
Then he added,
"We have to bring it down like our brothers in Chicago."
The missile man aimed his launcher. The 797 was appearing off to the left. His aim would be exact. He pulled the trigger, and the missile blew straight up into the sky, leading the approaching jet perfectly in its approach. In the cockpit, bells went off. The co-pilot automatically slammed down on the countermeasures button. 2 flares shot out, heading for the incoming missile. The pilot next to him was yelling, "What is it? What is it?" But before he could get a response, he could see it on the screen.
The flares had diverted the heat-seeking missile from its trajectory slightly, but just slightly. The pilot and co-pilot could see the missile for a split second. The pilot prayed aloud that the missile would not hone in on the heat from his engines. "Get away! Get away!" The missile shot past the jet with a trail of smoke. It kept traveling due west, and eventually fell harmlessly into the Pacific surf, a half mile offshore. 3 hours later, a group of Navy SEALs and the L.A. Bomb Squad located the missile and defused it. For some reason, the explosive never detonated. The RTS system hadn't been utilized. Chapter 4. In the Colorado Rockies, Joshua Jordan and his wife Abigail had been riding their horses. Earlier that day, they had taken the pass that wound through the tall pines and eventually ended at the barn near their log mansion. Now the ride was over, the horses had been stalled, and they were walking in the door of their massive retreat house. Both were wondering when they would hear from their daughter, Deborah, who was expected at the Denver airport. Joshua migrated to the big family room with its high timbered crossbeams and turned on the internet television set. Then he took a few steps back and dropped into a cowhide chair. On the end table were pictures from his years in the Air Force, before he'd started his own defense contracting company. One framed photo showed Joshua and a former president shaking hands after his successful surveillance flight over Iran. Another showed him with several members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The third, his favorite, showed Abigail back when she practiced law with a D.C. firm. She was heading down the steps of the federal courthouse in Washington after arguing a case to the Court of Appeals, one of many she would win. Suddenly, Joshua's attention was drawn to the ticker scrolling across the bottom of the screen. Northern Air flight from Chicago crashes on takeoff. Fear no survivors. Flights from LAX and New York turned back. Joshua yelled to Abigail, who dashed into the room. Joshua pointed at the message that was still scrolling. A look of panic came over Abigail's face.
Flight numbers? What flight numbers?
They haven't given any. What's Deborah's flight out of JFK? Where'd you write that down? Abigail dashed to her study. Joshua was trying to make sense out of it. Three flights in three parts of the country. One crashed, two turned around. This is sounding terribly familiar. Chapter 5. Washington, D.C. Mike Leakey sat at his desk eating a Cuban sandwich and slurping Mountain Dew from a plastic bottle. He was hitting the Dew because he needed an energy boost. He'd been out late partying the night before. His job at the U.S. Geological Survey, National Climate Change and Wildlife Science Center, was to analyze weather data, specifically on global warming. Sometimes the endless stats all seemed to blur together, like today. He chugged more Dew while he reviewed the latest printout in the empty computer room. As he studied it, he groaned. Oh, no, man, no. It seemed clear that he had entered the 100-year average rather than the 1-year average. So he loaded the parameters into his computer once again, this time making sure he was asking for the 1-year average. He punched enter and waited. Bored, he decided to wander down to the office of his supervisor, Dr. Henry Smithson. When he got there, Smithson and Ernie, his assistant, were glued to the little internet television set. When Mike started to ask what they were watching, Smithson put his finger to his lips and pointed to the screen. There was footage of the smoking, charred wreckage that had landed in the Chicago neighborhood. Smithson said, "This is awful. No facts yet. The NTSB is investigating but isn't talking. Someone on the ground thought they saw an explosion in the air, just to make sure other flights are being canceled. Know anyone flying today?" Mike shook his head. "Me neither." Smithson hit the search function on his remote, and on the right-hand column of the screen a series of web logs and Insta news articles appeared. All were reporting the same thing. Smithson scrolled down. After 15 more entries, all nearly identical, one finally looked different. It was from a new web and wire service called Amerinews. The headline read, "Missile sighted in Chicago, heading for doomed plane." Ernie chirped out, "Hey, look at that!" and pointed to the headline. Smithson just grunted back. "Amerinews? You gotta be kidding, Ernie. Bunch of crazies. Members of the Flat Earth Society. He clicked off the Google search and enlarged the TV footage. Mike hung around for a minute, watching the gruesome coverage, then looked at his watch and figured he should get back to work. In his office, Mike checked the screen, hit the print button, and after a few seconds collected his papers. He sat down with the Earth Temperature Average Index and reached for his Cuban sandwich. He took a big bite and savored the crunchy, thinly sliced dill pickle and the spicy meat. It was just the way he liked it. He chewed once, the side of his cheek bulged. Then he saw it, at the bottom of the last page of the index. He nearly choked. He coughed and gagged. He was so dumbfounded that he'd forgotten to keep chewing. This can't be right. No way. He scanned every page, following the trail of data point by point until he got to the end. It made sense mathematically. It all fit, except for the one-year average. That had to be wrong again. But it wasn't. It was correct. He checked it. For a moment, Mike felt as if he was about to have an out-of-body experience. I must be going nuts. Or was it something else? If the data was correct, it meant that the newest average worldwide temperatures were climbing to dangerous levels. Catastrophic global warming had finally kicked into overdrive. Due to carbon dioxide emissions from cars and factories? Of course. There could be no other scientific explanation, at least not one that was respectable. When Mike realized what that meant, he snatched the papers and sprinted down the hall like a maniac, his frenzied footsteps echoing off the linoleum floor. He reached Smithson's office. Dr. Smithson and Ernie were still watching television when Mike burst in. His frantic entrance made the Ph.D. of climatology and his research assistant whip around in their chairs. Mike raised the papers in the air. His face had the stunned look of a pedestrian who almost got hit by a bus. God help us! It's happening! Chapter 6. In the conference room of Eternity Church in Manhattan, the small group of men had their own special custom for meetings of this kind. No cell phones, no wireless handheld devices. That meant they were temporarily cut off from the news of the day, and that they could focus on the subject at hand with a hydraulic kind of intensity. Today they felt a palpable atmosphere of anticipation, though no one said it aloud. It was like being on the beach when the tide suddenly sucks back, and you know a tsunami is about to hit. The chairman of this small biannual conclave was Paul Campbell, head pastor of Eternity Church, which was housed in a historic brown brick cathedral in downtown New York. 43, athletic, and with a calm kind of kinetic energy, he had a passion for the study of Bible prophecies. The other six members of the group had the same passion. Two of them were professors at seminaries. Two others were pastors. One of them was the head of the Israel Study Institute in Jerusalem. And then there was the oldest, Doc, a retired president of a Bible college who had authored expositions on the books of Daniel, Ezekiel, and Revelation, and during his long ministry had picked up a master's degree in archaeology as well as a Ph.D. in Semitic languages. They had spent the last hour in prayer. Each felt a crushing burden for what they saw off on the thin line of the horizon. A seminary professor led off. "We've met here together for the last 3 years, contemplating and debating, wondering what we would do if this day ever came in our lifetime, and now it's here." "And yet," one of the pastors said, "we all know the admonition from our Lord, standing on the Mount of Olives." Another pastor chimed in, quoting, "Of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only." One of the seminary theologians had a point to make, the same idea that he had voiced before. "But remember what event the Lord is referring to in that passage. Not the events leading up to his coming, but rather the actual occurrence of his physical appearance, which means that we might be able to identify the pre-appearing events, the stage setting, so to speak, with great accuracy, while still not knowing the actual day or hour of the second coming of Christ." Doc cleared his throat loudly. The room grew quiet as he took a swig of water. He removed his tinted glasses from his wrinkled face and put them on the table. He was not prone to speak quickly. He would choose his words carefully, like a sculptor cutting a face out of marble, with each blow calibrated just so. He knew that every word, like a chisel on stone, had consequences. His voice was weak and had the tremolo of age.
Great events cast long shadows. Can we deny that we see the shadows of these epochal events approaching? Some are even at our doorstep. Jesus upbraided the Pharisees, didn't he, for failing to read the signs of the times? Will we be like them, failing to tell the world the very thing that we see? While the world is saying that it is a good day because it's morning. Friends, we realize that the sky is red. How can we stay silent?
No one spoke for a full minute. Finally, Paul Campbell said,
I believe, just like the apostles of old, that we have to declare what we have seen and what we have heard. Tell the truth, unvarnished, and let the chips fall where they may.
No one dissented. So it would begin. Chapter 7. After 3 desperate hours in their Colorado retreat, Joshua and Abigail Jordan finally heard the voice of their daughter. They were both on the line. Abigail blurted out,
Deb, are you all right? Our flight got shaken up a bit. I have a few bruises, but I'm okay.
Abigail sighed.
Thank you, God. What in the world happened?
Mom, I'm not sure. The plane took a dive. Things flew everywhere. Then we returned to JFK. They've been interviewing us nonstop, but not giving us information.
As a former Capitol Hill lawyer, Abigail wanted the backstory.
Which agency questioned you? The NTSB?
Yeah. National Transportation Safety Board. Right.
Anyone else?
Guys in suits. Probably FBI.
Gee, why don't I remember for sure?
That caught Joshua's attention, and he immediately asked, Why'd they turn your flight around?
I don't know, Dad. One minute we were taking off, the next minute the plane goes into, well, it almost seemed like evasive maneuvers, and then everything went crazy.
Any talk about this being connected to the Chicago plane?
What?
Joshua realized his daughter knew nothing about the Chicago crash. He decided to drop it. Never mind, honey. Just let us know how soon we can see you.
While jets are being grounded, they're giving us priority on the new westbound flash train. I'll board today and be in Denver tomorrow, and with you guys by tomorrow afternoon.
Joshua, a decorated colonel in the Air Force and former spy plane pilot, had cut his teeth on military flying, not commercial, but he knew something about flight incident investigations. His most recent stint as the premier anti-missile defense contractor with the Pentagon had also brought him into contact with many federal agencies, the NTSB, the FAA, Homeland Security, and the National Security Agency among them. By now he'd already guessed that his daughter's flight was somehow connected to the Chicago disaster.
Oh, there's something I have to tell you, Deborah said.
She didn't give either parent a chance to process before she continued.
I'd like to bring someone to Hawk's Nest, so you can meet him.
Abigail threw a look across the log-beamed living room to Joshua, who was sitting by their 5-foot-tall fieldstone fireplace.
Explain, dear,
Abigail said in a tone freighted with a parent's expectation.
Exactly who you're talking about?
Mom, this guy is former Air Force, and Dad, guess what? He worked in defense contracting with Raytheon.
Abigail pushed a little.
How long have you known him?
Well, just a few hours.
Across the room, Abigail was shaking her head. It wasn't adding up. Joshua said, Sweetheart, this isn't making sense. You're probably shaken up.
Dad,
she began, and her parents could hear the depth of emotion in her voice.
He saved me during the flight, kept me from getting a broken neck or cracking my skull.
Deborah, what on earth?
Abigail had had enough. Now she was going to launch into one of her skillful, impassioned cross-examinations. Seeing that, Joshua waved his hand toward Abigail as if to say, not now. This is too sensitive for a phone conversation. Abigail decided to pull back.
Darling, she said, just come home quickly. We love you so much, and we're glad you're safe. Your brother's coming in a few days.
Hopefully flights will be back to normal by then. Cal's in Boston. We'll all be together. I can't wait to hug you.
After they clicked off, Abigail strode over to the sofa where Joshua was sitting and dropped down next to him. She grabbed his powerful hand and ran her other hand through her hair. Joshua, as usual, was doing the stoic thing, but she could see he was carrying a 200-pound weight on his chest. They sat silently, absorbing what their daughter had told them, scant as it was. It sounded like something terrifying had happened. Abigail said she wanted her daughter home 10 minutes ago. How frustrating it was that their private jet was down with repairs. Could they charter another private jet to pick Deborah up? Joshua shook his head. Abby, I know what you're thinking. I'm there too. But by the time we lined up a charter, she could be heading home. Let's stick with the plan. Besides, I don't want to flag Deborah to the federal folks.
You think something's going on, don't you? This was not just a random plane crash.
With all we've learned and seen, we have to expect anything. They disappeared into their own thoughts. Abigail broke the silence.
Josh, what she said?
The words caught in her throat.
She said someone saved her on that flight.
Joshua was rocked by the fact that his daughter's life had been at risk, but he was also thinking about the Chicago flight and the fact that the FBI had interrogated Deborah and the other passengers from her flight, 4 states away. He couldn't shake the feeling of catastrophe and responsibility. Both jets were 797s, and he knew something about them. He had designed the RTS anti-missile system installed on those planes, and he had a vested interest in commercial air safety. His own daughter had been on a National Airlines flight with his RTS device on board. He had to find out why the Chicago flight ended in disaster. And right away. Was this just a tragic air accident? And if so, then maybe it was pilot error or equipment failure. Major wind shear at takeoff? One thing he did know. There was a possible explanation for the crash that he was dreading. He wasn't a person who prayed, a religious type like his wife, but what he said silently in his head sounded awfully familiar. Please, don't let it be that.
Chapter 8, Washington, D.C. At 5:45 a.m., William Patch, retired Navy Admiral and now National Security Advisor to the President, was hunched in the back of a government limo as it motored along the Washington Parkway. He had no idea which route his driver was taking because it changed every day for security reasons. Patch wouldn't have gawked at the scenery anyway. Most days, like today, he was absorbed in the contents of the leather-bound folder on his lap. It contained the latest national security data that he was to present in his briefing to President Virgil Corland, scheduled for 6:30 a.m., There were the standard State Department memos, diplomatic cables, a Homeland Security report, the usual. Recently, the Department of Agriculture had begun filing its own reports. They wrote about the growing Dust Bowl in the Midwest, and their concern was that the unending drought, coupled with the bizarre pest infestations, had decimated American agriculture, putting a lot of farmers and food industry workers out of work. The DOA's latest speculation was that those conditions might create increased domestic unrest and possibly create homegrown right-wing terrorists. Patch thought it was bunk, that it would take the national security focus off the real threat, and he said so. The intelligence guys, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, and the CIA had agreed with his assessment. But the mood in the Situation Room had been different lately. Politics was trumping everything. Not that political realities weren't factored into every decision made in Washington when it came to war and peace. Bay of Pigs, Vietnam, Kosovo, Persian Gulf 1 and 2. But now there had been a seismic sea change. It wasn't just about politics either. Geopolitics was running everything. Now there was talk from the president, and even more from Vice President Jessica Tullerud, about a global security coalition, and less talk about American interests. Patch's file also contained a short summary of his briefing from the CIA. As usual, when it came to the agency's written outline for Patch, and for everyone else for that matter, the CIA kept it concise and cryptic. The spy guys wanted to keep things up their sleeve until the last minute,
until it was their turn to brief President Corland. This morning, Patch's file had memos from the FAA and the NTSB concerning the Chicago air catastrophe of the day before, as well as the near misses at JFK and LAX. He looked over the photos of the crash scene and spat out several of his favorite sailor's cuss words as he looked at the carnage. He came to a one-page statement from the office of Vice President Tallroad. He read it carefully. Then a second time. He swore again, this time even louder, trying to vent all of the steam out of his system before the meeting. On the other hand, he thought, maybe I should just tell the Vice President where to go and be done with it. In Patch's mind, there was a cancer in the White House, and it wasn't coming from the Oval Office. It was coming from a little farther down, from the VP's office in the West Wing. 45 minutes later, in the Situation Room in the basement of the White House, the President's National Security Advisors were seated in the black leather executive chairs around the long walnut conference table. On the walls, digital screens flickered with intelligence data, charts of international hotspots, and today, a cascade of images from the crash of Chicago Flight 199. President Corland was flipping through a report. His face was pale and haggard, his skin an unhealthy pallor. In the harsh glare of the ceiling lights, he looked even worse. The President brushed his hand over his partially balding head as he read. He looked up and started the meeting. "Let's begin with you, Admiral. This air crash and the other two flights. No question about who was behind this?" "No question. Al-Aqsa Jihad, a splinter group of Al-Qaeda. What's their beef with the United States, as if I have to ask? Our support of Israel?" "Right. Okay. What are we doing to round up these murderers?" The deputy director of the FBI chimed in. "We have a dragnet around the greater Chicago area. Same with Los Angeles. We have solid leads. We'll find them. We have positive IDs on several of them already. As for the Long Island group, we believe they were all killed in the attempt." "How'd they get their hands on heat-seeking missiles?" There was an awkward pause. Admiral Patch filled in the blanks. "There's evidence that Arab sympathizers within the military transferred Stinger missiles to enemy hands." Helen Brokstead, the director of Homeland Security, a tall, bland-looking woman with close-cropped hair, was shaking her head vehemently. "Mr. President, the facts are very much in dispute on that. We have to be careful not to make hasty accusations based on racial profiling." Vice President Tallroad, sitting at the president's right, nodded, her pageboy hairdo waving. She held her finger out like a place marker for her turn to talk.
"Yes, I agree with Helen," she said. "Mr. President, let's get this train back on track. The real question is where we go from here."
Admiral Patch pulled out the note in his file from Tallroad. He said, "Madam Vice President, it appears that your suggestion is that we tell the American people very little about the incident."
"Just what they need to know, Admiral."
"So," Patch continued, "you really think that we should tell them only one missile was fired, the one that downed the Chicago flight, and nothing about the JFK and LAX near misses?"
"Admiral, that's what my note said," Tallroad snapped, pointing to her memo, which was now on the conference table. "Mr. President, we could deep-six the entire airlines industry if this gets out of control. I've already given all of you my advice that we lift the lockdown on commercial flights we imposed when this happened. This nation is tottering on financial catastrophe. Before the missile strikes, all but one of the airlines had already gone into bankruptcy, failed to reorganize, and are now under federal control. Our foreign credit is precarious. What we say publicly about these incidents is going to be crucial. And even more importantly, there's our international partnerships, our new global coalition. There are worldwide values at stake here. The new global society we are trying to build. Peace, gentlemen, peace."
"You know, they used to call this the National Security Council," Patch growled. "Now it's sounding like the United Nations Glee Club." "That's all, Admiral," the President responded. "I understand your devotion to national security. Everyone does. But we have to work as a team here." The CIA liaison from the Office of Collection Strategies and Analysis raised his hand.
"Mr. President, we have some data."
"Let's hear it."
"About the FBI report, the wording, I mean. You heard it in the briefing just now.
The statement was that there was an attempt to launch a missile at Flight 433. That report implies that the suspects were blown up when the missile, which they tried to launch, somehow detonated in the warehouse before being fired. But we have a visual from the NSA. It picked up what looks like a missile heading toward the 797 jet. But then it does a U-turn in the last third of the flight pattern and heads back to the warehouse where it exploded. Also, in the first interview with the folks in the cockpit, the pilots said that the alarms and the deck screen indicated they were under attack.
Wait just a minute.
Tallrude was waving her hands. But the CIA guy plowed ahead. So it looks as if the RTS, the return to sender system on Flight 433, successfully turned around the incoming...
Now you just wait right there, Tallrude sputtered. The final report, the very last one, says just the opposite. That the cockpit crew renounced their previous statement about the missile alert warnings going off and about some incoming missile. They admit they were mistaken.
Looks like that missile wasn't the only thing that did a U-turn, Admiral Patch muttered, loud enough to evoke a few chuckles. Then, with a heavy dose of cynicism, he added, Of course... There's no chance that those pilots were pressured to say that.
President Corlin threw him a wearied look but said nothing.
I want this on the record, Jessica Tallrude shot back, slightly red in the face as she threw a pointed look toward the CIA liaison. I want to know how and why the CIA is getting domestic surveillance data from satellites tasked by the National Security Agency. That is a major breach of privacy of American citizens and is probably illegal. You people have no business using satellites to spy on American citizens or on American soil. Was permission obtained from the FISA court for this?
The CIA guy was nonplussed. This data regarded foreign actors inside the United States trying to shoot down our planes. Tallrude dug in.
I repeat, domestic spying that is probably illegal...
Brokstead jumped into the fray. There's enough dispute here, Mr. President, that I think we should be careful about what we say publicly. I suggest that we go along with the recommendations of Madam Vice President and limit our statement to the following. That a missile was fired at the Chicago flight, and the onboard RTS system failed to stop it, resulting in the tragic destruction of the Chicago flight. Period. Nothing about the LAX or the JFK flights being at risk. At least for now. To the left of the president, Hank Strand, his chief of staff, had a suggestion. Mr. President, a thought. We could simply say that the LAX and JFK flights were rerouted back to their airports based on preliminary security information. Out of an abundance of caution. The pilots on both flights would back us up on that. President Corlin sighed and asked his chief of staff a simple question. Would that be the truth? Hank Strand grimaced, tried to smile, and then said, Well... in a manner of speaking. All right, Corlin said. I'll think on it, Hank, and get back to you in a few hours. Now, good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all. When everyone had cleared out of the room, Vice President Tallrude and the President's Chief of Staff stayed behind. The Situation Room was impenetrable in terms of security, acoustics, and privacy, and they knew it. Tallrude started.
Well... I bet this changes Corlin's decision about who's going to be on his list for the Medal of Freedom.
Hank Strand looked worried. Don't be so sure.
You're kidding.
No, I wouldn't joke about something like that.
He's got to be nuts if he doesn't change his mind.
Madam Vice President, I'm telling you, things are different with him lately. I'm not saying we are losing control.
Let's hope not.
Then she thought about something.
Are the White House physicians still talking about the same diagnosis for Corlin?
Yeah. TIA. Transient ischemic attack.
Next time he has one of his blackouts, I could demand an immediate transfer of power to myself.
Constitutionally, I could do it, and Corlin knows it.
So what are you noticing?
He's less compliant. More unpredictable. And he's changing course on some policy issues. I'm worried about whether he'll keep his promise to you.
Tallrude tapped a painted fingernail against Strand's chest. Just make sure he does. He's got to know he can't run for a second term. I've kept my part of the bargain. I haven't told the press about his medical condition. Now he has to keep his by putting his seal of approval on me publicly and then declaring he won't run again.
She couldn't resist another jab at the president.
Did you hear him today?
his question. Would it be the truth, he asks. Since when did he become such a Boy Scout?
Hank Strand was about to say something, but Tallrude cut him off.
You're sure Carlin's not keyed into the fact that I've been meeting with you behind his back?
Not a chance.
So, when's he announcing the recipients of the Medal of Freedom?
Tomorrow.
And the ceremony?
I think he wants it quick, in a few days. In the Rose Garden.
Jessica Tallrude gave a disgusted shake of her head and turned to leave. She tossed out one last comment as she left.
I'm glad I won't be there. Especially if he still insists on hanging a medal around Joshua Jordan's neck. That would be political suicide for him if he's still holding on to the crazy notion of a run for a second term.
With that, she stopped in her tracks. A thought broke through like sunlight. Her face relaxed. It was no longer the hard, bitter look the vice president would occasionally flash when things didn't go her way. Instead, it was the look that she had been working on for her public appearances and the photo ops. Now she was smiling and nodding with her own personal revelation. Virgil Corland aligns himself with the controversial weapons dealer Joshua Jordan. Corland's ratings crash, making it even more difficult for him to change his mind and seek re-election, and forcing him to stick with our plan. I distance myself and push forward to the primaries. People start thinking, why was she ever vice president anyway? She should have been president. Yes, this could be a good thing.
Chapter 9. Boston, Massachusetts. Cal Jordan looked absently from the front window of the crowded main room of the Reardon Art Gallery and out at the traffic on Harrison Avenue. For a moment he was oblivious to the 74 patrons, art aficionados, and buyers politely milling around with glasses of punch in their hands, taking in the array of paintings with their heads cocked forward to study every detail, pointing and talking to each other in hushed voices as if they were in a cathedral. He had even forgotten, for one brief moment, that three of the paintings on display that day were his. There was a time, not long ago, when Cal would have thought it incredible that his art would be on display in a place like this, that even as a college student he would find his work in the company of some of the East Coast's best artists. But he wasn't thinking about that, or the cordial, well-heeled manners of the art enthusiasts around him. His mind was elsewhere, back in a dark, ugly place, hands tied, duct tape over his mouth, staring into the face of a sadist. In that harrowing place, only two things stood between Cal and certain death: God and his father, Joshua Jordan. Sometimes he wondered whether he confused one with the other, taking his father too seriously, with too much fear and awe, and not having taken God seriously enough. But in the cold, sickening fear that had paralyzed him during that incident, Cal cried out to God from the bowels of his soul. The NYCPD bomb squad eventually showed up and rescued him, but he suspected at that moment, and later knew for sure, that his father had been the one behind his rescue. Of course. Which made Cal wonder what he thought he was doing now at an art gallery in Boston. He was having second thoughts. He was sensing a change of heart about what he wanted to do with his life. But was it really because of his own prayerful sifting and weighing? Or was he just trying to please his father? After his rescue, he naively thought that things would be different with his dad. But he came to realize that, yes, in matters of life and death, some things can change in a heartbeat. But other things don't. At least not that quickly. Then a familiar voice interrupted his thoughts.
Wow! I am so impressed, Calvin Jordan. At the Reardon Art Gallery.
He turned around to see the pretty face of his ex-girlfriend.
Karen, what are you doing here? In town for a family thing. My folks read the blurb in the paper about the show and saw your name.
Cal smiled, even though he and Karen shared some painful memories. So, I don't see you on campus, but suddenly you show up here for my art show in Boston?
Yeah, I've been super busy. Music, drama club.
And still dating Jeff?
Karen reached out and squeezed his forearm.
I'm sorry how that all happened.
I'm over it, really.
I tried to call after the news about what happened. I couldn't believe it. So scary. Oh my gosh.
Thanks, I know. I got your messages.
My fault.
After all that, I wasn't in the mood to return calls.
She nodded and shifted uncomfortably. Then she said,
"You look, I don't know, different. Bigger. Wow, you really do. You look good. Been working out or something?"